may ask him questions. They don't yet have the ability to get on the air and ask us directly. The majority of information flows by direct voice contact on the air during this TechNet. A little bit of information flows by other means where Mel deems it necessary. In other words, a beginning amateur, they go to the top of our priority list. We are not promising free written consulting service that's beyond the call of duty. The TechNet has existed for 28 and a fraction years. What you're listening to is TechNet number 1,363 of the series that began way back in September of 1982. Long time ago. A lot of water under the bridge since then. So at the end of that first hour, Mel goes to the mailbag. After that, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us the latest of what NASA is doing. And after that, we go into the deeper subjects. Not everyone's pleased with the deeper subjects. Know ahead of time that's going to happen. You can be forewarned, just be forearmed. And if that kind of material displeases you, then you've got 800 channels on your 2-meter radio. You can tune to one of the other 799 channels, if you know what I mean, is my suggestion. There are people who think that brand new material is inappropriate, and there I disagree. Because real people with real curiosity, it's the curiosity that causes real progress. And yes, new material that you've never heard before is always uncomfortable. That's the normal human condition. It's not unique to you if new material that you've never heard before makes you feel uncomfortable. That's the learning process. If you feel uncomfortable, most of the time you're really learning. So you can sort of expect that. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 28 years, we believe somebody is listening. Otherwise, the TechNet wouldn't have existed for that length of time. And also, there is 6 years of recorded TechNet that you can listen to by going to a website, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, and there you'll find 6 years of past TechNet. And some of them are documented as to what subject is being discussed during each 5-minute period of time. So there's quite a wealth of information there. You'll also find information about tuning dipoles, how to get perfect match, impedance match to a dipole by very simple means, how does a Smith chart work, how do decibels work. There are individual articles also on that website where the creator of that website, who is Mike Perry, KC2NJI, does a heroic job of documenting all of that information. Okay, please give me your call letters and name right now. A typical sign-in would sound like this. John, KC2WGB, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters if you have a question or a comment. K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2MIT, yes.
Okay, K2MIT, I should know your name. Please tell me your name, sir.
Jeffrey.
Very, very fine, Jeff. Okay, that person who just signed in, we didn't catch them. Give it again, please. Okay, extremely noisy. You're going to have to find a better location. I could tell there was a human voice there, but I couldn't hear anything specific, and I'm wearing earphones. Want to try one more time?
This is KB2, Victor, Bravo, November.
Okay, KB2, Victor, Bravo, November. And I think you're in the Bronx, is that true? And what is your name, sir?
My name is Freddie over here in Far Rockaway.
Okay, Freddie in Far Rockaway. A little bit noisy, but you found a pretty good location there, Freddie. He's number 2 on the list. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes at this time. K2RIW.
WS2N with the space report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. And last week, Paul, you knew you had a question that you thought of during the week that you didn't think of. If it suddenly occurs to you, come right back to us and tell us you got a question. And we got you on the list for the space report. Glad to hear that NASA's doing something. One last call. Anyone else give us their call letters and name, because they do have a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight. Give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
K2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Mel. After Mel and Paul, if you can, Dick, I have an intent question.
Very fine, John. Okay, John with an antenna question. One of my favorite subjects. Turns out antenna engineering is a subject that is very poorly taught, I'm discovering. One of the companies that I work with looked at someone's resume this last week, and the person went to a very fine American school. The person has a doctorate degree in wireless technology and antenna engineering in particular. The person had taken 5 individual courses, many of them at the doctorate level, in antenna engineering. And we and a few other people interviewed that person. And the person had a 3.85 scholastic index out of a possible 4.0, a nice doctoral thesis on the subject of using radio frequency identification devices for doing digital signal processing. Very elaborate type things. But because the person had so little exposure to the real world of industry, of the way radio and antennas in particular are used in industry, they had nothing but academic background. And because the professors that were guiding this person, their mentors, also had no professional experience, only academic background, there was a huge disconnect between the way it's taught, the way it's really practiced. And so that became very striking to us as we interviewed this person. So as you've been hearing me say for some time, we've got huge evidence this particular week that the schools, even the very good schools, are doing a fairly poor job of teaching wireless technology. You'd be amazed how many companies, you'd be amazed how many companies are basically saying, if you really want somebody that understands radio and antennas and propagation and wireless technology, you probably have to hire a ham radio operator. That may be the only way that you really get the experience. Either that, or you find one of those very rare individuals who has worked for a company doing that kind of work. He happened to work under the wing of somebody who acted as his mentor and mentored him for 10 solid years, and he's got that much experience, that much, what's the word for it now, apprenticeship. That seems to be the way you get a wireless engineer, 10 years of apprenticeship, or 10 years of active ham radio application. So although you guys may not feel it, you are the experts on radio, the people who are listening to us right now. We're passing information back and forth. We, being the experts, are the ones that have to teach our local community that wireless techniques, wireless hardware, is not harmful to human beings. Radio is your friend. It's not your enemy. There's a ridiculous number of individual towns and villages that are writing very strict rules trying to outlaw cell sites from their town. Very counterproductive, strong misunderstanding. And so we amateurs have to slowly teach the people in our community that wireless radio and cell phones and cell towers are all very safe, and they're a huge safety item when it comes to emergency services being required. You've heard me say that a lot of times before. Let's see what Jeffrey wants like to talk about tonight. You got it, Jeff. K2, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Boy, would I love to have those call letters. You got it, Jeff. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, I hope this guy you're interviewing didn't go to MIT. And a short, quick story, then my question. A scared mother called me because they wanted to put a cell tower 185 feet from the nursery school where my kid was going to school, and said, "Do you support this?" I said, "Yeah, of course I do." She said, "What? It's terrible." I said, "No, the effect of radiated power of that antenna is nothing compared to the phone you're putting up right next to your head, so of course I support it." Let me let it drop.
Yes, I'm going to set a couple words in that one, and that is, you go through the mathematics of a nearby object running milliwatts of power, a cell phone in your hand right up against your head, as opposed to being 180 feet away from a cell site. The difference in the amount of radio energy that gets into your body is more than 1,000,000 to 1. In other words, a cell phone against your head is safe, but it is 1,000,000 times stronger in the amount of radio energy it puts into your body compared to living exactly next door to a cell site 185 feet away during drive time, during rush hour, when the cell site is running full blast. More than 1,000,000 to 1. Of course, people, when they first hear that, are going to be very skeptical. You do a deep enough search, and you'll confirm it. Back to you, Jeff. Sorry to interrupt you. K2RIW. You said the right words.
Yeah, no, I had calculated about 850,000, but I like million to one, sounds better. Here's my question. I have a tri-band antenna on a quad pod, so it's a 10, 15, 20 meter antenna, and about 12 feet above that antenna is a 6 meter antenna. And what I'm missing is 12 and 17, the warp band, and I found that I can get an antenna, a directional antenna, Yagi, for those two bands, and I was wondering if I would have a problem if I sort of mounted it in between, so it would be 6 feet below the 6 meter antenna and 6 feet above the 10, 15, and 20 meter antenna. I don't have modeling software, so I don't understand or I don't know how the vertical component would interact with the intended radiation pattern. So you said we're going to talk about antenna, so my first question is antenna related. So for me, this is something I just don't get into, so I love your expertise in this matter. Thank you very much.
Fantastic, Jeff. You came to the right place. I've got a lot of good news for you. And the good news is based on hands-on experience, real measurements. With a little bit of study, you'll find out that every device that does any receiving, I don't care if it's an ultrasonic receiving microphone, I don't care if it's a UHF or a VHF or a microwave antenna, I don't care if it's a photocell, everything that receives a signal or transmits a signal, in either case, it has an effective capture area. You can rather easily calculate the effective capture area of your favorite antenna on your particular frequency by knowing that the area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Gain times lambda squared over 4 pi. You plug in the numbers, and you know the effective capture area in square wavelength. If you plug in wavelength as meters, you'll know it in square meters. If you plug it in feet, you'll know in square feet. You'll know the effective capture area. You can make a fairly easy assumption that the effective capture area is nearly a circle. In other words, if I look down the throat of one of my 19-element Yagis on 432, a so-called RIW-19 Yagi, I've done that experiment, I've done that calculation many times. It has approximately 15 dB of gain over dipole. Let me drop. You go through the calculation, and you'll find out that it's got, I forgot what the number was, 27 feet, I think it was, effective capture area. In other words, if your eyes operated at that frequency and you looked down the boom of the Yagi from a long distance away, you would see a black hole in space approximately 5.5 feet in diameter. All the energy of the right polarity coming down that antenna in that direction, 5.5 feet in diameter of it, it's all going to be focused by those directors down to the driven element. 99% of that energy ends up on the driven element, goes down the feed line, and moves the S-meter on your receiver. Everything has an effective capture area. So if you're stacking antennas together, and they're all on the same frequency, remember those words, on the same frequency, you can calculate those effective capture areas, you can convert them into circles, and you can set up the antennas at the right spacing so that the circles are just overlapping a little bit. You don't have to have them just kissing each other. They usually do it for overlapping a little bit because the effective area and the stacking distance is a bit of a compromise. You get a little bit more gain when you stack further, but the lobes become a little bit more narrow and there's more of them, the side lobes increase. So there's a compromise there. So on the same frequency, that's what happens. Once you understand the way a Yagi works, a typical Yagi has in the vicinity of 10% frequency bandwidth. Let me drop. When you go beyond that 10% or so, particularly if you go 50% or 100% beyond the frequency, and even if you're on a harmonically related frequency, easily can you measure the gain of the antenna, and it goes way down. Rarely is the gain anything more than a dipole-like gain, and usually even below that. So when you're off frequency, the gain of the dipole, or the gain of the Yagi, goes to much, much lower numbers. Therefore, the real effective capture area becomes a much smaller number. The bottom line of all this is that when you're stacking antennas together and they're on different frequencies, you do not calculate the individual areas and space those areas. You can do that if you want to. You're being super, super conservative. You're going to be chewing up a whole lot of mass space and a whole lot of extra altitude if you do that. It isn't going to crash and burn, just that you're going way beyond the requirement. Even if I'm using a 2-meter Yagi alongside of a 432 Yagi, where there's a 3-to-1 frequency relationship. Common sense would tell you the 2-meter Yagi elements are going to all resonate on the third harmonic, 432, and therefore the effective capture area is going to come back. Good guess? No. Because in order for a Yagi to work right, each of the individual directors have to be mistuned by just the right amount, a little bit shorter so that they're a capacitive loading device in space, and each of those elements have to be the exact correct position. A Yagi is a number of parasitic elements where each element is the right amount of off-tuning, higher frequencies for directors, lower frequency for reflectors, and just the right spacing. So even that 2-meter Yagi on the third harmonic, the frequency offset is not right, the number of elements is wrong by a 3-to-1 ratio, the gain is not there. So even if you're stacking a 432 Yagi and a 2-meter Yagi, you can stack them amazingly close. Your 6-meter Yagi, you told us you put it 12 feet above the tri-bander. That's a good number. You went way too far. Let me drop. In my opinion, you probably could have stacked that 6-meter Yagi 6 feet above the tri-bander, and there would be essentially no interference. The experiment that I've done on multiple occasions on my own antenna range, a ratiometry antenna range, which you can read about in the February 1976 issue of QST Magazine. A ratiometry antenna range in the backyard, properly tuned, can resolve a 20th of a dB of gain increase or decrease. So on this not very good-looking but very high-performance antenna range, ratiometry antenna range, I started stacking antennas real close together to find out what happens. And what I discovered is that as you stack Yagis together that are on individual frequencies, only when the Yagis are so close together that the longer elements on the lower frequency add capacitance to the tips of the elements on the higher frequency, only when they're stacked that close, which is usually a couple of feet apart, then you start detuning those elements. The extra capacitance tunes the elements to a lower frequency, and you start losing gain in performance. If you're willing to retune the elements, you can make that all come back again. There are a couple of brands of Yagis where you've got various bands of Yagis on the same boom. They're stacked together, zero spacing, if you know what I mean. The extra capacitance of the nearby larger elements was compensated. They shortened them accordingly to bring them back to the right resonant frequency, and you get full performance. I could stack together a 6-meter Yagi, a 2-meter Yagi on the exact same boom. And with a little bit of retuning, I could make that all work with zero vertical spacing between the two. So once you know that the primary method by which you get degradation of performance is capacitance. And it doesn't matter whether you've got a horizontal piece of tubing as part of your support, which is collinear with some of the elements, and it's adding capacitance, and you can retune. Or if you've got a vertically polarized Yagi held on a vertical piece of mast, and you wonder if...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And you worry, is the vertical mast disturbing the antenna? And by way of it's adding capacitance to the two nearby directors, yes. And if you retune those directors, you can bring it right back to full performance. The effective area of that mast is so small compared to the real effective area of that Yagi that it's giving you a tenth of a dB of degradation by shadowing effects, as long as the mast happens not to be a resonant length. If it's a resonant length at that frequency, other things happen, but you can easily detune for that. So the bottom line of all this is that you can have ridiculously close spacing. Another example of this is John Fandel, W-A-2-F-U-Z. He used to live in Levittown. He built an array of 4 Yagis on 2 meters, and in the middle of this array of 4 Yagis, he put 8 Yagis on 432, all of them mounted into the exact same bed spring support structure. We measured the pattern of his 432 antenna. We measured the pattern of his 2-meter antenna by him swinging it with the key down, and I made a strip chart recording 15 miles away from him, if you know what I mean. And each of the patterns are exactly what the prediction would be, as if the other band wasn't there. And he was doing moon bounce on 2 meters and doing moon bounce on 432 by having them interstitially stacked together in the exact same bed springs setup, if you know what I mean. So you can find some very conservative articles, like Dave Olean, K1WHS, the guy who is the president of... Dave is the president of Directive Systems in Lebanon, Maine. Real good guy, makes some very nice antennas. Unfortunately, Dave fell into the trap of listening to other people who said that when it comes to stacking antennas together, you add up all the individual areas and stack them away from each other. He didn't make it clear that that is not true when the antennas are not on the same frequency. So you can read some very authoritative articles from very respected people who occasionally have this, in my opinion, significantly in error. They're asking for spacings that are way beyond the requirement. So I recommend you go and try it. The worst that will happen is that it's not going to catch on fire. It's not going to crash and burn. The worst that will happen is that if you want to transmit on band A, at the same time you're listening on band B, yes, the cross-coupling between the two, because receivers are so sensitive, you may get some receiver overload if you don't have the right kind of a filter. That's not what we're talking about. What you really want to know is, will the gain be there? Will the pattern be there when I have close spacing? And the answer is almost always yes, and it's a lot closer than you think. Make sure you wait for the free beeps, Jeff. K2, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. K2 RIW in the TechNet.
Wow. That was great. That was like being in the classroom. I really appreciate that. And you know what? Listening to all this all these years, I actually understood it. And I feel good. Thank you very much. This is a great service. K2MIT, thanks for answering my question.
Doug, recognize. I'm going to go over to you for a second. And, hey, Mel, we've got another happy customer. He gave us a testimonial. We have to send him a bill for our services. And that's a joke, Jeff. Not to worry. Doug, I think you've got a question on this particular subject. If you do, go right ahead with your question. And if you've got a question of your own, let me know, and I'll put you on the list. So the A2SAY, our Eastern contingent. Make sure you shout into that microphone, Doug. You're still a little bit low on modulation there. So the A2SAY. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2SAY back to net. Okay, I have to call you on something, I'm afraid. Back in the beginning, you said that cell phones are safe. There seems to be some question about that. I don't argue at all about the cell towers. It's the cell phone itself, which may not be all that safe. When you consider that certain people practically live with the thing glued to their ear. And there does seem to be some question as to whether there could be some brain damage due to the radiation from the cell phone. Back to you, Dick. WA2SAY listening.
Very fine, Doug. Oh, you're expressing an extremely popular opinion, Doug. One of the most recent, fairly authoritative articles on that exact subject, New York Times Magazine, April 17th issue, Sunday, this year, April 17th, 2011, on, what page number is it? Oh, I can't even see the page number, but I don't think. Looks to me like it's on page 31. So on page 31 of the Sunday issue, New York Times, the colored section, April 17th, 2011, you go to the archives, you can read that. The article is entitled, Do Cell Phones Cause Brain Cancer? That's the name of the article. And it's about a 10 or 15 page article, very well written. And so the bottom line of that is that when you read the article and you look at the number of brain tumors for United States citizens, the number of brain tumors per 100,000 in the population, and you try to look at the number of brain tumors before cell phones were there and now that cell phones are there, is there a significant increase in the number of brain tumors? And the answer appears to be no. And it's another one of these situations where, is it safe? Well, in order to say it's absolutely positively safe, you'd have to prove a negative. And that's the most difficult thing to prove. Prove that no human being was ever injured by a cell phone usage. And that's a very difficult thing to prove. But the epidemiological record, how many people per 100,000 get brain damage on the side of their head where the cell phone is operating, let me drop for a minute. And if you wanted to really stretch the data, where there's something like 8 brain tumors per 100,000 in the population. I don't remember the exact number, but it's something like that. 8 brain tumors per 100,000 is what you get per year in the United States. And if you could make a case that one of those is due to a cell phone usage, the number is 9. And so you get one extra person per 100,000 who gets a brain tumor. You may be able to make a case for that. And now it's one of these situations where we really, if you want to be realistic, you have to evaluate the risk-to-benefit ratio. I could easily convince you that 50 people per 100,000 are now alive because they were involved in an automobile accident and because of the cell phone, emergency services were rolling toward them in 60 seconds when somebody made a cell phone call and hollered Mayday, and that person is alive because of that. So I could make a case that, that 50 people are alive and one person got injured. By the same token, 40,000 Americans per year die in automobile accidents. Should we outlaw automobiles? We all know that the automobile gives us a huge amount of benefit. We all go to work with it, we all go shopping with it, we go to school with it, whatever. As such, we're not going to stop using automobiles, even though 40,000 people die from them. So again, it's a risk-to-benefit ratio. In the case of the automobile, you make sure you've got a safe car that's got good crash survivability, you take your defensive driving courses, you drive conservatively, and you do the right things, and you make everything in your favor. By the same token, if you really believe the cell phone is creating brain damage, then start using it with the Bluetooth device, where the cell phone is held further away from your head. If that would make you feel safer, go ahead and do that. It's not the wrong thing to do. But as you can tell, it's a very difficult case to make, in my opinion, on the data that I read. Now, one last thing I'm going to say on this one. Because this is a highly emotional issue, I can easily find 50 at least articles on various websites on the internet telling you that every use of a cell phone is creating brain cancer, every new cell site that you establish is putting a blight on the community, and all kinds of bad things are happening. You can find a zillion articles like that. The first thing you have to ask yourself is, okay, the person is expressing a heartfelt, strongly emotional, felt opinion, and sometimes it's based on anecdotal evidence. A person who used the cell phone a whole lot in my school got a brain cancer, and he got it on the side of his head where he used the cell phone. That's what caused it. Very easy to do that. I can find a zillion of those articles. First thing you've got to ask yourself is, how well documented is that article? Does it represent real statistical data that has statistical significance? How many brain tumors per 100,000 in the population? That's the way we really rate things around here. You can easily find a physician who does brain surgery who says that, yes, I get a whole lot of cases of people who are using cell phones and they get brain tumors. Well, with modern-day techniques, he is well advertising his services. He's a well-known brain surgeon. He's getting a lot of business because he's well advertised. And is that the reason he's seeing extra patients with that problem, as opposed to in his past when he wasn't well known? There's a lot of variables involved. So it's not an open and shut case, but you can sort of sense my opinion on that one, Doug. But it's a darn good question that we should all continue to discuss, because it's far from a completely closed issue. For the A2SAY, you sound good when you shout into the mic. You got it, Doug. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, WA2SAY back. I may have missed that. I usually get the time, but I may have missed that article. I have read some indications that when I guess they did CAT scans or something like that, they found that there was a change in the distribution of the blood supply to the brain when cell phones were frequently in use. Personally, I use the cell phone. If I put on 10 minutes a year, that's about the average. So it doesn't really apply to me anyway. But, when you see somebody walking around a supermarket with a cell phone in their ear, you wonder. WA2SAY, back to Ned. Take it away, Dick.
Yeah, I'm with you, Doug. It's a good thing to be conservative about. If you have any doubt, then limit the amount of exposure. And by the way, because you can measure an effect, in other words, the main determining report, and let me backtrack. If I listen to any zoning board hearing or any town board hearing on the subject of should we allow this new cell site to come into the town, and you get all kinds of people saying, not in my backyard, it's unsightly, it creates brain damage, it does this, it does that, you get all kinds of people. The saddest thing, in my opinion, is that not one human being in any of those meetings, not one person from the mayor and all of his supervisors and all of his people that help him, his cabinet of people, not one of those people ever quote the C95 report. The American National Standards Institute publishes a report called C95. It's got a very long title, but it's a microwave radiation and human beings and the effects between the two. the American National Standards Institute, in that report, it represents 60 or 65 years of continuous research on man and RF radiation. 65 years. The report has over 1,000 references that represent the best institutions, the best measurement laboratories, the best colleges and whatever, where measurements have made. And what's the bottom line of all that? The bottom line is that for 65 years we've been looking for the non-thermal effect. And you could say with 98% assurance there appears to be no non-thermal effect. In other words, when RF energy hits a human being, the only thing it does that can be documented is it creates some heating. Well, if I lie in the sun on a sunny day with my bathing suit on the beach, 1,000 watts of solar power are going into my body. And the body can handle that. And you've got this couple of milliwatt thing next to your ear called the cell phone. And if all of the power out of the cell phone enters your body and creates heating.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because the brain has such a prodigious flow of blood through it, which is a beautiful cooling fluid, I think you would have great difficulty proving that any portion of the brain is being heated by more than 0.1 or 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit because of the use of the cell phone at full blast power, because you're at maximum distance away from the cell site. And it's a power-managed system. It adjusts its power accordingly to the range. So if you're very far away from the cell sites and the thing has to run at maximum power, the majority of the heating you're getting is the battery runs hot in your hand, if you know what I mean. So you're creating some extra heating. The fact that you can measure the change in body performance. By the way, the only thing that they've really been able to confirm is that when you do a double-blind test and half the people are using an active cell phone and half the people don't know what they're using an inactive cell phone, and you have them do mental mathematics, the people with the active cell phone are able to do mental mathematics a little bit faster. You heat up brain material, and it does its calculating a little bit faster. So you can measure minor effects like that. You now have to ask yourself the question, is it a deleterious effect? The extra heating that I'm getting, is that going to create a brain cancer? Well, if so, the heating you're going to get when you go to the beach or you sit in front of a light bulb is also something you've got to worry about. So the chances of the deleterious effects of cell phones, there's 5 billion of them being used in the world today. 300 million cell phones are being used in the United States today. And we've got roughly 20 years of experience with these things. So we've got a lot of epidemiological data. And so when you look at brain tumor rates, for instance, you can't see a significant change just because people are using cell phones, even the heavy cell phone users. So, and even if you could confirm that one or two or three extra people per 100,000 who are for some reason susceptible, and therefore when they use their cell phone, they're a little bit more likely to get a brain tumor, even if you could prove one, two, or three people per 100,000, the average person would not respond to that. You can tell everybody you know that 40,000 people per year die in their automobile. Not one of those people is going to slow down the slightest bit as he's walking through his automobile with the key in his hand. He's about to open the door and he's about to drive away. It's not going to happen to him because he takes these other safety factors and whatever, and we all believe that we're slightly invulnerable. So even if I could prove it, I don't think it would make any substantial difference. But if you want to be super safe, okay. Use an earpiece, use Bluetooth and whatever, place the thing further away from your body if you believe that that's a problem. And now you're being super conservative and super safe. You may not have to do that, but there's a simple defense to that. There's one other point that I made with an article that I had on the internet a couple of years ago. Let me drop. And that is, if I could absolutely prove, which I can't, but if I could absolutely prove that the use of your ham radio equipment, with all the extra RF energy that goes into your antennas that are above your house and the handy talkies you put in your hand and whatever, if I could absolutely prove that your IQ throughout your lifetime is going to drop by 2 points, you normally have an IQ of 115 and you're going to go down to 113 because of your use of ham radio throughout the 50 years of your lifetime that you're doing ham radio. If I could absolutely prove that, how many hams would give up ham radio and take up stamp collecting? And even if they did take up stamp collecting, there's a risk there, too. You've got to make sure that you're using non-latex rubber gloves, because you don't know where some of those stamps have been when you're touching them to collect them into your stamp book. There's a risk-to-benefit ratio in absolutely everything we do. If I could prove that your IQ is going to drop 2 points because of your ham radio usage, would you give up ham radio? 98% of us would say no. I'll go to QRP operation. I'll make sure the antenna is further away from me. I'll make sure the coax cable is well shielded so I'm not getting any of the RF. We wouldn't give it up even if it could be proven. And to prove it would be very difficult. So we're talking about extremely small numbers here. And the emotional words that people use because of the word RF radiation. I wish it had been called RF transmission, RF signaling, anything else, RF propagation. People associate the word radiation and microwave radiation. They assume it's the same thing as nuclear radiation. And the two are very, very different, almost no comparison. So it's an emotional misunderstanding of a vocabulary word, radiation. Each time I talk to any of the people that are very strongly against cell sites, my goodness, do they have emotions. Wow, let me drop.
K2KE, why are we coming?
Mel recognized, going to go over to you in a second. The people that I run into, and I just ran into, I just came back from a party, and I ran into a man who was on a committee that made a presentation before his town board because somebody wanted to put a cell site near his school where his child goes. And boy, was he strongly against it. He says, don't you realize this radiation is hurting all those children and they're all getting sick from it, and if we allow this, this, and this is going to happen. It took me an awful long period of time to very slowly explain to him, have you read the C-95 report? Did you ever know that it even exists? Do you realize the United States has been doing research on this for 65 solid years? Do you realize that the Bureau of Radiological Research in the United Kingdom has been doing a similar study for 60 years? There's a German organization, there's a United Kingdom organization, there's a Japan organization. They're all doing this kind of research, and all of those documents describing minimum permitted exposure, maximum permitted exposure, they all hang together. They've all discovered the same thing. They've all discovered there are thermal effects, and no one has been able to document and reproduce non-thermal effects of RF energy being exposed to human beings. And on top of that, the word microwave is another strongly misunderstood word. Because we don't understand it, it's got to be bad. That's what an awful lot of people have as an attitude. Pound for pound, microwaves are 5-to-1 safer than VHF and UHF. Because at a microwave frequency above 1,000 megacycles, 20% of the energy that hits your body penetrates, 80% reflects right off the skin. It doesn't even penetrate in the first place. The microwaves that everyone's afraid of are actually safer. You say that in front of a zoning board, in front of a town board, and they basically will say, what planet are you on? And I ask them, have you read the C-95 report? 65 solid years with well documentation. You look at that graph, and that's what it says. If you disagree with me, tell me what you believe is error after 60 years of that report. That report is the defiant...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The C-95 American National Standard Institute report is the defining document for the United States. It is the base of data that's used for the Department of Defense, for OSHA, for NIOSH, for any of the organizations that write any kind of well-documented standards as to what antennas you're allowed to put, how close to human beings, with how much radio energy you're allowed to put in those antennas. The base, the bedrock of all of those standards goes back to that C-95 report. I didn't say it's easy to get a hold of a copy. I didn't say it's easy to understand. It's written in pretty deep technical language. The report probably goes on for 200 pages. There's a lot of stuff there. But that is the defining document. And so for people to say, gee, we used to think asbestos was safe, we found out it wasn't. We used to think cigarette smoking was safe, we found out it wasn't. We think radio was safe, we're going to find out it's not. That doesn't compute, because those other things, we haven't been studying them for 60 years, 65 years. Radio has been studied from a radio frequency biohazard effect on human beings and other animals. It's been studied for 65 years. If you're not familiar with those studies, then you're not speaking correctly. And later on, I'll repeat the so-called situation that happened in Lyon, France, this year. A very interesting case happened there. But first, let's hear from Mel. K2KEY. Are they putting any more cell sites into Manhattan Beach, Mel? I hope so, so you have good coverage on your cell phone. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, that's not the problem. It's just K2KEY. You don't know what I got myself into, taking an 817 to the hospital. That's you think that this is going to go away, boy, this is really embedded in the mind, because they sure gave me flack with the 817, over.
82 Adam, okay, I heard an extremely weak signal, and I couldn't copy the call letters. We're going to turn it over to you in a second. So, you brought your 817. I know why you're getting these treatments in the hospital. You're using your battery-operated 817. Most likely, you're using 99% of the time you're doing receiving. If I know you, you do a little bit of transmitting on QRP, but most of the time you're receiving. Somebody saw this radio equipment alongside of your chair while you're getting your treatment at the hospital, and somebody started giving you grief. Give us a few more words on that, and I know it's a tough one, Mel. When people have an emotional opinion on this subject, RF radiation, and quite often they start off with the attitude of, my mind is made up. Don't confuse me with any more of those facts. K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel. K2RIW.
Okay. No. I took it in. I was in the infusion center. We get the chemo. And they saw this, and they said, because I have the microphone also hanging on there, on my collar. And, I got the 817 swung over my shoulder with the shoulder strap, and I got the other thing. I carry my paperwork. I got another shoulder strap, and then I had my chemo kit. That's another strap. So I start taking all this stuff off me, of course, and I lay it down right next to my chair, my console where I lay down. And first thing is, what the heck kind of contraption is that? That's one I've never seen before. So I explained to them, it's an amateur radio piece of equipment. And, oh, it's not on. I said, no, I don't turn it on in the hospital. This is, first of all, it won't work so well in the hospital, number one. Number two, I said, the antenna's not on. If the antenna here is separate in my case. So, but you should hear this. They threw up a few. Well, you shouldn't be bringing that in here. Over.
I am guessing, though, after you get your treatment, they want you to sit there for a certain length of time before you drive home, and probably you then sit outside in the sun, and there you connect the antenna and do some receiving. Is that approximately what takes place, Mel? Go ahead.
I got a lot of time between everything. First thing you do when you get there. I don't know if I ever should go into details. I don't want to, really upset too many people. I don't think that's the object of the TechNet, but there's a time element between getting there and blood tests, and then seeing the oncologist. There's time between that, and then there's the mixtures. It's a time element between each thing, which usually runs into at least an hour and a half to 2 hours, everything. So I find a lot of times just to relieve my anxieties and all. I go outside, I have a nice park out there. And it's a bit of a noisy area anyhow with all electronics or whatever goes on there. It's not a great location, but I go out there, just turn the 817 on, listen to some HF, or once in a while make a contact on VHF, UHF. Not a heck of a lot of activity, but that's about all. Never turn it on inside the hospital. If you don't, wouldn't hear nothing, and first of all, I don't think they'd like it, over.
Sounds to me like you're doing it the safe way, Mel. And during the number of hours they've got you there, one day a week or 2 days a week, you have something to amuse yourself, to listen on your radio during all those hours, is a very reasonable thing to do. And of course, you're an unusual person. All ham radio operators are unusual persons. There's only one ham operator per 500 people in the general population in the United States. And many other developed countries have very similar numbers, one ham per 500 or 1,000. Out of curiosity, you may know that there's also one private pilot per 500 in the general population. So we have the same frequency of people in technology, whether you're a pilot or a ham radio operator. So we're a little bit oddballs. We have to accept that. And therefore, we can easily be misunderstood. So I'm pretty sure you've got a very defendable case for your situation. And I think they're becoming overly alarmed for not good reasons. As again, it's the attitude, if I don't understand it, it's got to be dangerous. A lot of people have that attitude. And there are times that that's not justified. There was another person with a very weak signal who wanted to check in and give us an opinion on this particular subject. Try one more time. Give us your call letters. K2RIW on the TechNet. And your name.
KD2, Adam Oscar.
K2MIT with the comments.
Okay. Adam, Oscar, Oscar, and Jeff in that order. Adam, Oscar, Oscar. I'll start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment on this particular subject. Adam, Oscar, Oscar, KQRIW.
KB2, Adam, Oscar, Oscar. Name here is JD. And a quick comment. Probably the most dangerous thing about cell phones is people being distracted while driving. I ride a motorcycle, and I can tell you it's very easy to see how distracted people are and they don't see you. Probably causes more injuries than RF.
Yeah, when you say probably causes more injuries than RF, we can't confirm any RF injuries, but without a doubt, people who are using their cell phone, waving their hands in the air, shouting at somebody they're having an argument with while they're driving, or in even the worst case, when people try to do text messaging while driving. Oh, my goodness. Ridiculous. There's only 10 ways you can die or kill other people by doing that. And thank goodness various municipalities are coming up with laws trying to make that illegal, and people are getting citations for doing it, but it's a very dangerous thing to do. To use a cell phone at all, even hands-free, you have to worry a little bit about the fact that you've got divided attention. But if it's a non-hands-free, and you've only got one hand on the wheel, and you're trying to hold onto the cell phone and dial a number while driving, that's crazy. You can almost justify it if you happen to be on a parkway and you can't pull over and you've just seen a great big accident and you want to call some emergency services. You can almost justify it that way. But to call your wife or your son or your grandmother while you're texting because you're bored, while you're driving and because you're bored, that's very difficult to justify. Jeff, K2MIT, go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, first, most cell phones don't have yagging antennas inside them, so all of the radiation doesn't go in your head. They are omnidirectional. So I would guess you're getting half of the output of it, or potentially even a third, depending on where the little antenna is in your phone. And about the only thing that I remember from my physics class was the only thing that could potentially have a problem thermally is your eye. If you were to direct a radio wave, I think the resonant frequency of the eye is 18 hertz, something like that. If you were to get a yagi and almost put it down your throat, press there, put it close to your eyes, you could heat up some, with a big enough signal, you could heat up someone's eyeballs, and they would boil. Other than that, there's nothing that I can find in any literature that anything is happening up in the brain area.
J-4-I-L-K-L.
The only thing you should worry about is staring at things that aren't resonant frequency of our eyes. I'll leave it at that, but I do believe most people do argue this thing on emotions. And, you know, there's a difference between fact and opinion, and you have to know what the difference is. In my case, I'll let it go with the facts.
Very fine, Jeff. I'm going to address what Jeff has just said, then we'll try to pick up K4ILK, I think it is, that signed in by Echolink. The most vulnerable part of the human being to radio exposure is the cornea of the eye. You study all the parts of the human being, and you start creating heating by way of radio means. You're aiming a radio signal at a human being, and what's the most vulnerable part? The eye. The reason the eye is the most vulnerable part is that it's the part of the body that can tolerate the least amount of temperature rise before becoming injured, and it doesn't have a temperature sensing device inside. When your eye is being cooked with high heating, your eye doesn't feel hot, if you know what I mean. Your eyelid maybe can tell, but your eye itself has no thermal sensing. So the current standard, which is roughly 1 milliwatt per square centimeter of maximum permitted exposure, is because of the eye. And the eye has a thermal time constant of 6 minutes. In other words, from the time you start heating up your eye with some kind of external source of heat and the time you measure the temperature starting to level off, it's roughly 6 minutes. So therefore, the American standard of roughly 1 milliwatt per square centimeter is based on 6 minutes of exposure at that level. So if you did stand in front of an antenna that's giving you 1 milliwatt per square centimeter and you stared straight into it with your eye open and stared into it for 6 solid minutes, you'd be at the threshold of alarm by the American standard, but that American standard already has either 10 or 20 decibels of conservativeness, extra safety factor built into it. Let me drop. Because for a whole lot of years, the American standard was 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, maximum permitted exposure. And that, where did that come from? That came from a measurement that was done in the late 40s on a white rabbit. You took a white rabbit, clamped him into a fixture, his red eye was staring straight up in the air, and they put some kind of clamping device on his eyelid to hold his eye open, and they aimed radio energy at his eye. And they found out that for more than 6 minutes of exposure of 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, in the next 24 hours, he would start to develop a cataract. So when the animal couldn't move, and he's staring straight into the source of energy for 6 solid minutes, at 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, you do measure some measurable change in the opacity of his cornea. And so they divided that by 10 and said it's safe for a human being. Well, a human being's got a lot more mass. You're not going to sit still that long with your eye open and so on. You can see there's multiple levels of conservativeness built into the American standard. So the 18 hertz you heard about really is 6 minutes. 6 minutes is what? 3,600 seconds, something like that. 360 seconds, I guess it is. Is the exposure at roughly 1 milliwatt per square centimeter is the current standard. Let's see who that other person was. K4ILK, question mark. K2RIW in the tech net.
KJ4ILK. I might have to ask. That's why they say, hey, don't put the HT too close to your eye, because even very low amounts of power can, like you said, damage the eye tissue, and that's why they suggest a external microphone and possibly put the radio behind you or above your head or somewhere where you're not as likely to get exposed. And that's why I might ask around that next FanFest, you might want to purchase a external antenna or a antenna extension for your HT, so you can put your HT antenna somewhere safe. KJ4ILK, and here's Ricky in Lafayette, Georgia. Over.
Very fine, Ricky. You brought up a very good point. And so did Jeff. For reasons of very limited real estate allocated to the antenna placement in modern-day cell phones, the antenna used to be a little whip sticking out, and for a whole bunch of aesthetic reasons, people have been insisting on cell phones with no external antenna. They don't realize they've taken a great big hit in antenna performance because they forced it to be inside. As you know, the iPhone 4, I guess it was, ran into a whole lot of problems because of a thoroughly external antenna. So if I took the cell phone running full power because of maximum range from my local cell site, and I hold the cell phone directly against my eyelid, I think you'd be pushing your luck. The total amount of energy that would be coupled into your eye that way could be beyond the American standard. But you don't use a cell phone that way. It's way away from your eye. It's way off to one side. Your eye is being blinked a lot. You're moving your eye back and forth. You're not holding it in this dangerous way for 6 solid minutes. But the eye is the most thermally sensitive part of the body as far as potential damage is concerned. Let me drop. By the same token, there are people who have developed a premature cataract because night after night they would sit in front of their fireplace with the glowing embers against the hot back of their fireplace, and they would stare into that. And again, the heat that radiates off their fireplace into their eye can create extra heating of the eye and give you a cataract. So, and by the same token, I imagine if day after day you lie in the sun with the sun directly beating on your closed eyelid without wearing sunglasses, and you get that extra heating because you're doing this on the beach, you potentially could get a cataract from that. So you got to worry about raising the temperature of your cornea, of your eye, by whatever means, radio, sun, fireplace, whatever. It's something to be aware of. Now, the case I'm talking about that happened in France, let me drop. And this is a beautiful case that was described in Antennas and Propagation Journal. I think it was the approximately the April issue, 2011. In the back of that issue, they describe a situation that happened in Lyon, France. Lyon, France, I think, is where the judgment was made that actually took place in an adjacent town. A cell site was erected alongside of an apartment building. The people in the apartment building started developing some serious health effects. Lack of concentration, nausea, inability to sleep, and inability to speak clearly, and whatever. They developed a whole lot of, looked like medical problems because of the cell site nearby. And they filed, all these people, a large number of people in this apartment building were putting tinfoil across the windows and doing all kinds of things to protect themselves from all this RF radiation happening from the cell site that was right alongside of the apartment building. They filed a couple of lawsuits in Lyon, France, and the judge in Lyon said there is no evidence that there is any validity in all of these complaints that the cell site is the causative agent. But because there's such a large number of people experience such a large amount of grief and all these medical problems, for the time being, the judge in Lyon said, okay, I will make a judgment that the cell site has to be removed. And that judgment came down. The people who were ordered to remove the cell site said, this is crazy. We had established the cell site. We put up the tower. We hadn't put the antennas on it yet. It wasn't operational. Once you realize that, you realize that all of these medical problems that all these people had in this apartment building were purely psychosomatic. And boy, they all convinced each other that they were slowly dying because of that cell site nearby. So, as you can tell, there's a huge difference. Again, there's a million-to-one ratio between having that cell site, cell phone against your head versus living directly next door to the cell site itself.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because of the inverse square law. For a whole bunch of reasons, it's very difficult for you to get any closer to that antenna than 200 feet. And you compare 200 feet versus the half inch or quarter of an inch that you can place the cell phone against your head and use inverse square law and readjust for the power of the cell site. The cell site can probably run as much as 30 watts when every one of the carriers is running simultaneously during drive time versus a cell phone in your hand probably can't run more than 300 milliwatts on the worst case situation when you're the maximum range from the cell site. You put that all together, and you can easily do that in mathematics. You'll find that it's more than a million to one. So if you think a cell site is dangerous, then your cell phone is a million times more dangerous. But I don't think the cell phone is dangerous. I think there's a whole lot of unjustified emotion going on here. Okay, you guys are the experts. You're going to have to slowly convince the people in your community. Radio is their friend. It saved a hell of a lot of lives by way of what's going on with the fire department, the police department, the cell phones themselves, and the emergency services like your ambulance service, which all get dispatched by local antennas. Let's go over to Freddie. Freddie, go right ahead with your question. Kilo Bravo 2, Victor Bravo November. Make a quick brother transmission first to make sure we're hearing you well, Freddie. K2RIW, wait for the beep.
K2EL, repeater, system.
Freddie, you're extremely noisy. We're only going to get 75% of your words. Is there a place where you can move a little bit differently and then pose your question? Go ahead, Freddie.
My question is, when are they going to update the radio system?
I only heard three quarters of your words with my earphones, and I think your question is, when are they going to take the radio? You're very noisy, Freddie. KB2 VBN, K2LIW. K2MIT,
what's the question?
Yeah, Freddie, I can tell, has an address in New York, New York. He's in Manhattan. He's probably buried somewhere between the marble canyons there. And so he's having a lot of trouble getting the question to us. Something to do with radio, when they're going to change it, and fire department. Transmitters to get better coverage. Go ahead with your question, Jeff. K2MIT, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2 is in HI comments.
When are they abandoning 800 megahertz? EMF services are migrating to some gigahertz frequency, 2.4, 1.2, I can't remember. And then they're going to auction off, I think, the 800 megahertz
frequencies. I think that's what he was asking about. My question was, I was just trying to Google this. I want to read more about this Lyon thing, but I can't find it. Do you know the town it was in, or just give me some keywords? I tried Lyon, cell phone, and sickness, and that didn't pop anything. I just wanted to have something that's a little closer to the... that I can find out more. That's just such a funny story.
It sure is. The best I can do, let me drop